evening. This is Mae Breslin, Carmel, California. It's tape number 397. It's July 13th, 1979, and it's side one of this tape. You subscribers to the tapes are a special breed of people, and you're especially curious and keep up on the information that's coming out around the world, and I appreciate your concern and your subscriptions. And I'm going to share a little bit with you each week, maybe, on the book that I'm doing, because I know all of you are interested in that book. After 15 years and articles and lecturing and teaching two college courses on the assassination, I'm finally sitting here in Carmel writing the book, and I love doing it. I'm working very hard, and I don't want to take much time away from it except for the tapes and the mail and the necessary work. And most of you know that the book is titled Doubles. Right now I'm working on the doubles about Lee Harvey Oswald. I won't go into too many details about it, but I want to share with you some information which will be in the book, which has not yet been made available to anybody else in the United States. And it's because I appreciate all of you that I'm going to share this with you, because I'm cross-filing, as I've told you before, the incidences of where Lee Harvey Oswald was in one location and where the Warren Commission or evidence came along to support the information that he couldn't possibly have been in that specific location. He was in another place altogether. And, of course, the Book of Doubles is why the doubles were created, the meaning it has for today's understanding of our government and the espionage system. I'll just give you one example of a double that I was working on this week to show you how exciting it is. And as I say, this information has never been made available to any person that I know of, any researcher. So I'm going to share it with you. After Lee Harvey Oswald was arrested, that was on the 23rd of November, the day after he was arrested, the FBI made out a report in the jail. They interviewed him, and they made out a report about Lee Harvey Oswald. In this report, Lee Harvey Oswald was 5 feet, 9-11 inches, weighed 140 pounds, medium brown hair, Social Security number 433-543937, draft board number SSN 41-114-39532, U.S. Forces in Japan services number 1653230. That's just to identify a section of the FBI report. The Secret Service, the Treasury Department, made out a report November 26, 2 days after Lee Harvey Oswald was dead. Their report had Lee Harvey Oswald at 5'11 inches. This is the Secret Service report. He weighed 150 pounds, which was 10 pounds more. But one of the very important pieces of this puzzle that has been missing for a long time is on a document, as I say, I'm sharing it with you researchers. No one else in the country that I know yet has it, and it will come in my section on the doubles. The Secret Service report to identify the person they're talking about being the different height and different weight has the identical Social Security card number I gave you. They have the identical draft board number. They have the identical U.S. Forces in Japan service number. But there's a section in the Secret Service report, along with the other descriptions, details of his service and his marriage and so forth, and it says, last school attended, latest school attended, U.S. Armed Forces Institute, Madison, Wisconsin. Location and date completed, March 23rd, 1959. Now, in volume 23, page 800 of the Warren Commission hearings, the commission has a chronology, as it has several other places, of where Lee Harvey Oswald was. And in 59, he was stationed in the Philippines and in Japan. He was in Southeast Asia, with the mailing address being El Toro Marine Base in 1959. He was discharged from the service in September of 1959 and went on to the Soviet Union. But they have him flying home from Southeast Asia and attending U.S. Armed Forces Institute, Madison, Wisconsin. So the Warren Commission has him in Asia, not Southeast Asia, but in Asia, in this time period, the Secret Service has them at the Armed Forces Institute in Madison, Wisconsin. Now, in the minutes of the Warren Commission meetings, published by David Lifton, January 21st meeting was a controversial meeting where Chief Justice Earl Warren met with members of the Warren Commission to cremate that Lee Harvey Oswald. I have that on other tapes, and you have it on your printed sheets, the parts of the minutes of that meeting, to cremate Lee Harvey Oswald before they began their investigation. And the Warren Commission ordered the cremation of the 5'9" Oswald. That was the autopsy report, the FBI report. But the day after the meeting where they ordered the cremation of that vital evidence, one of the Lee Harvey Oswalds that I'm studying, that next day, January 22nd, they had a meeting, and the minutes included a conversation of sending Lee Harvey Oswald that he attended Monterey Presidio Spy School, which is the school for languages for intelligence agents. Now, Oswald's superior, Mr. Donovan in the Marines, told how Lee Harvey Oswald had some books on Spanish and books on Russian, and he took a Russian exam in the Marines. He was trained in the Russian language, so before he defected to the Soviet Union, he was flown home to the U.S. Armed Forces Institute, Madison, Wisconsin, and I think now we can pinpoint that he was sent to Presidio out here in Monterey before he went back to Japan. Over there, they probably thought he was taking a sick leave or was in the brig or was on a vacation for a short time, but in March of 1959, he was at the Armed Forces Institute in Madison, Wisconsin. The Warren Commission had him over in Japan and in the Philippines. So this, I believe, is the same Oswald, except that the Secret Service records are the 5'11", and the FBI records and the autopsy are 5'9". Now, this is very important because there are many people like Michael Eddowes and Robert Sam Anson and other writers that claim that an Oswald was 5'9", and in the Soviet Union, he was enlarged and shrunk and changed, and they sent home a sleeper that was not Lee Harvey Oswald. But I have traced people who were doubles for Lee Harvey Oswald that were in Europe the same time he was there, and even in Morocco. But this story of the Secret Service report identified with the same exact numbers. They're talking about the same person, the Selective Service number, the Social Security number, the U.S. Marine number, same person, 2 days later, different heights, different weights, going to the Armed Forces Institute. That will be a very important part of my doubles book. It's about the fourth incidence of Oswald being in two locations, at least on the books. And I thought I'd share it with you because it's very important information for you researchers. As I said before, I don't believe in saving all this material and hoping to publish it in a book and get out a lot of bombshells when the book comes out. We know what happened to Karen Silkwood when she carried her evidence about Kerr McGee to the New York Times and was to meet reporters and tell about the leakage of the radiation in the plants where she worked and the mishandling of the material that was causing deaths and cancers. I believe in letting this material out and sharing it with you as I work so that you know what I have here and not waiting for a particular day to hand it to a publisher. It should be in your hands and you should know it's in my study and copies should be made, and I don't want the responsibility of holding it like she did her reports, because when her car crashed, all that material was taken out of the car, and I don't know if they ever got duplicates of what she was doing. So I think I should share a little bit of this with you every week so you know the material I have and the direction that I'm going. I didn't mention last week a subject which was very dear to my heart and important for me, and that was the statute of limitations vote in Germany. It was voted 255 to 222 that the war criminals would be subject to prosecution for all time. They wouldn't take a vote every 20 or 30 years. But what that means, and those of you that have the earlier tapes know what it means that Dr. Mengele's can't come out from hiding and have a big celebration next year with Martin Bormann or Mr. Wagner from Treblinka. There's about 30,000 Nazis, war criminals, still out there hiding. I've talked about this many times. Last May, well, it wasn't so long ago, tape 389, I gave you the address to write to Germany. I hope some of you take part in those decisions when I give you the address. And I don't know, I never ask when the tapes go out how many of you did write to Germany or how many could follow it up with to Germany now, telling them you appreciate the vote and the decision. I think it's very important. I know it's important in my own life to take a stand, and I wonder how maybe you just take the address, put it on your desk, and don't follow it through. We went to a family party last week, a Roots party of my father's family, and there were a lot of people there, and they were celebrating a combined birthday for several members of the family, and the 4th of July, and various members of the large family got up and spoke, and I spoke. I just got up for 1 minute and said that the Roots party was on the same day as the statute of limitations, the order taking place that it would be there for all time, and that this was a heritage that we would leave our children and our grandchildren, and that it was important to remember that day. And, of course, I think of all the family, I probably was the only one there who was even conscious of it or brought it up, but I didn't want them to forget it. And in celebrating what we have, we should be grateful for what we have, but we should remember the past and hold on to the future. And so I spoke at the Roots party about that. Some of you don't know my family. Some of you do. I might mention it real quickly just for 1 second on the tape. The party was held, first it began at the home of Isaac and Mary Magnan. Those are my great-grandparents who founded the I. Magnan store in San Francisco. At the time of the earthquake, the living room was the first store. They moved the merchandise into their living room. It's on the corner of Page and Mason Streets in San Francisco. And we all had drinks there. And the grandchildren, many of the grandchildren were at the party. Mary and Edgar, my father, it was his 89th birthday that week. And Cyril Magnan, who's 80, it was his 80th birthday. And my cousin Floria, great cousin, and cousin Mary. And those were all grandchildren of Isaac and Mary Magnan. And then Cyril Magnan started the Joseph Magnan chain. It was his daughter that gave the party, and his sons were there. Cyril is Mr. Protocol of San Francisco. He's the head to represent San Francisco and all heads of state come in, all dignitaries. He recently gave $500,000 to ACT. He's active in all civic affairs. My father is the sort of the head of protocol in Los Angeles. He celebrated his 89th birthday, as I say, and he just resigned this year. They wanted him to take the World Affairs Council as president for 2 years, and he thought on his 89th birthday 1 year was enough. He meets all heads of states down there and introduces them and goes to the White House and represents the city of Los Angeles. He does the invocations at all civic affairs where dignitaries come and have come through the years, people like even Lyndon Johnson and Khrushchev and every well-known head of state, my father's asked to introduce them and be at these affairs. And this party had the children and the grandchildren of these ancestors, Cyril Magnan's family, my father's family, my brother was there. All my children couldn't be there, just one daughter. But it was a large family, and it's a family of achievers, a lot of lawyers from Harvard, Yale, Stanford, men, women, working hard, studying hard. One cousin works in the Pentagon with Dean Rusk in the Defense Department. Another is at Livermore Lab with the hydrogen bubbles, and a cross-section of all kinds of people with a lot of social conscience, working hard, getting a good education, handsome people, motivated. But I would say that not one of them at the party, is interested in the things that I'm interested in the terms of the future for the children. They're not interested that West Germany investigated 84,000 Nazis and convicted 6,432, and a conviction was anywhere from one day to one particular man, Hess, who's still locked up. Men like Hallmar Schacht, who financed Hitler, the Reichsbank, got out in 6 years and then began to mobilize Aristotle Onassis, build German fleets and Japanese ships, and the Nazis located where they are strategically, who celebrate every year in Canada, Latin America, West Germany, are of no concern to these otherwise educated, financially secure people. And I'll tell you something, when the party took place, and maybe I'm talking too long on it, maybe I'm not, I felt 10 feet tall because they could talk about the children or the children's children, but you still have to do something for them. It isn't a society where you can sit back and expect somebody else to do it. And I did get up and talk about the statute of limitations. And the relatives, a lot of them know about my research, hear me on the air in San Francisco. Some are proud. Some wish I didn't do it, I suppose. They are embarrassed by your speaking up, but they're proud that you do it. They have that contradiction. They know who you are, but they wouldn't do it themselves. They're glad you're doing it, and they wouldn't do it themselves. And they'll play the social game. Cyril and his son-in-law brought the King Tut exhibit to San Francisco. They do all the right cultural things. But as far as I'm concerned, a safe world is a world that smokes out these people so they can't repeat what they were doing before, which they are still doing now. Now, those of you who did not write about the statute of limitations, who were bashful with your pen, I'm going to give you another chance to participate in making of history. An article in the Washington Post this week by Catherine Elson that 57 congressmen have written to President Alfredo Stroessner asking him to bring out Dr. Joseph Mengele, the boy from Brazil, the angel of death from Auschwitz. He stood at the door at Auschwitz and decided this one dies and this one lives. He did experiments without anesthetic on persons. He took twins from all over Eastern Europe, wherever he could get them, Jew and Gentile, and injected them, experimented on them, cut them open, compared them, and has done these extensive experiments on twins. I'm not out for vengeance. I want to know where his laboratories are. I have reason to believe he's been working the past 40 years. Those of you who know the tapes know I talk about Jonestown as the boys from Guyana. A few weeks ago, I talked about the space mutations and space law and genetic mutations. That's the heritage from this particular Dr. Joseph Mengele. Now, last week in San Francisco, there was a UFO conference. I wanted to attend, but I'm working on the book and decided not to split myself so thin. But one of the men, one of the main speakers, is a William Spalding, who just came out with an article. I'm giving you the address from the UFO magazine on UFOs and the CIA and Navy intelligence. And Dr. Hynek put on this conference. He's from the Air Force. Advisor on UFOs, and they are changing their tune now and saying that UFOs are man-made. We only have to go that one more logical step. If the UFOs are Nazi secret weapons, if they are made by NASA or the Navy intelligence or the Nazis, then the people that they're seeing, those men in black or those strange little dwarf people we talk about, are man-made. If the ships are man-made, the people are man-made. And that's why we have to find out about Mengele and his genetic contributions and his mutations. Now, three congressmen had a press conference, and I'm giving you their address: Matthew F. McHugh from New York, Christopher Dodd, and Robert Dornan, Jr. from California. Dodd is from Connecticut. They claim that they have proof that Mengele is a Paraguayan citizen since 1959, that he's been in Latin America, Canada, and Europe. West Germany and Israel want him, and Congress is considering $4 million economic aid to Paraguay, and that seems to be the price on Mengele's head. Give us Mengele's, and we'll go all the way with the aid for Paraguay. I don't care how they barter or what they do, but you know, I'm going to give you the address. I'm going to give you a little homework assignment. You know what I want you to do? I want you to write a letter to these people, these three people in Washington, and then to Catherine Ellison, and get the names of the 57 congressmen putting pressure on Stroessner. And you go to the grocery store, the library, or use carbon paper and copy the letter that you mail out and send it to me. And then wait and see someday if we get enough pressure to force Stroessner. I don't believe he'll do it, but we don't know what public pressure will do to smoke out Dr. Mengele's, and that you don't really have to turn it over to me. Keep your copies yourself and show them to your brothers, sisters, children, grandchildren. Show somebody that you wrote a letter about a situation that isn't over. It's not an old lost Nazi. It's a Nazi with laboratories, with secret airplanes that go in and out, with people that are marked, with mass murders down there, and send a letter for your own fun and your own self-respect, and write these men, tell them you appreciate what they're doing, and see if you too can get the same feeling that I have in having a piece of that action of trying to mold history instead of the inertia of thinking that somebody else is going to do it for you. The Kennedy assassination is in the news again. It's going to be there for 100 years. The stories of the Kennedy photo forgery report on autopsy finding. I'm sure most of you saw that this week. It was carried in the Associated Press and the United Press. The story that pictures of John Kennedy's head, the photographs were seen by Robert Groden, who assisted the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And those pictures we were told we never could see because they were too grisly and too gruesome. But Robert Groden saw them, and he claims that what is supposed to be a small hole in the back of Kennedy's head is actually a small, was not an entry wound from the back, but is a large gap that has been concealed from us for 15 years. The story was that they were trying to protect our sensitivities in seeing this picture, and now it turns out that Groden claims that they cut a hole in the negative and that there is a forged picture to change the shape of the wound, which would make it an exit wound, which means a gunman was standing over to the right and in front of President John Kennedy. Now, the story itself is interesting. It shouldn't surprise anybody what they can do with a little razor blade and some glue. You remember how E. Edward Hunt at Watergate was forging State Department papers to say Kennedy ordered the murder of DM. So if you can slice and cut a little and lock something up for 15 years, you can do that with the picture. The main point about this story, as I've always said, the country is ruled by bullets and blackmail, and once again, it was both. But I think it's important to get to the chronology of this event, because this news story just broke July 10th, 1979, but the time sequence is interesting when you think about the House Select Committee. They were given $6 million to find out who killed John Kennedy and Martin Luther King. The man who headed the committee, Mr. Flaky Blakey, organized crime Blakey. He's a crummy bastard from the FBI and CIA and Justice Department, had a hot potato, and they knew they could count on him. They thought they could count on him. And they gave him all this material, but it had to be guarded by the FBI and the CIA. The House Select Committee was caught because last summer, if you can get the humor of the timing, just last summer when the committee was just about to go public with their work in September, and they were quietly drawing 10,000 hairs on a piece of paper to make it look like the back of John Kennedy's head, while they were doing all that in the summer before the public hearings, this CIA man had broken into the offices as if it mattered if he broke in because they guarded it anyway. But he photographed the information. That was Regis Blahut. I put that on tape 394 and 395. The CIA had their agent who guarded the material. But he photographed the head wounds of John Kennedy. He opened the safe. He went through the files. And he left it open to let them know he took the pictures out of a plastic case. Now, why did he let himself be seen, and why did he go through all that? All this was happening in July, and this was just before the public hearings were to take place starting in August of 1978. Robert Blakey was caught beginning a public explanation of what happened to John Kennedy's head, where the CIA had photographed the material and the information and could shake him up if Blakey blamed the CIA for their role in the assassination. Now, the CIA was involved in the assassination of John Kennedy, but they weren't the only people. There's Navy intelligence and the Pentagon that did the autopsy, and Division 5 of the FBI, Defense Industry Security Command, and the Defense Intelligence Agency. There's a parallel to this story of the blackmail. The parallel of keeping the lid but blackmailing the people involved. At the time of Watergate, 9 months after the men were arrested and they could have gotten off with a low-level story, James McCord gave Judge Sirica a piece of paper and said, there's been a lot of lying in the Justice Department and the FBI. And his motive for breaking the case open was, I don't want the CIA to be involved. Now, the people that were caught James McCorgy, Gordon Liddy, E. Howard Hunt, Frank Sturges, Virgilio Gonzalez, Bernard Barker, Eugenio Martinez, Robert Bennett, Patrick Gray, were all involved with CIA counterintelligence. But McCord didn't want them to take the blame because they were also involved in the defense planning. Gray was a graduate of Annapolis. McCord worked with the Emergency Defense Department systems, and he didn't want the Watergate to be blamed on the Central Intelligence Agency, so he pulled out enough information that all the agencies would have to take the responsibility if they were going to blame the CIA. And the CIA photographer came in to keep information, I'm sure, to make sure that Blakey was handed a very hot potato. Now, one of the first witnesses called to go into the photographic evidence of John Kennedy's assassination was this pathetic woman who, as I say, drew 10,000 hairs for a price of $10,000, but we still couldn't see the back of Kennedy's head. When Blakey was hurrying for the last days of the hearing, which were a disgrace, he quick-handed back several hundred thousand dollars. He closed the committee fast, but when it was all over, the very last day, the very last hour, to save face, he produced evidence from a motorcycle cop's microphone to suggest there was a gunman at the fence over to the right of John Kennedy. They come out with a conclusion in their report, I'm sure, that Oswald fired the fatal headshot, but they closed it with the conspiracy at the very end, and I have the collection of newspaper articles and headlines, conspiracy to kill John Kennedy. So Blakey was caught having to admit there was a conspiracy, but not going one day further to find out who. Even though he had the money and gave it back, he didn't have to close the hearings. It's open for all time. He didn't want the potato, and he turned it over and said, the Justice Department can go from here. He didn't want any more to do with it. The Baltimore Sun headlines this week have a story, The Mob is the New Patsy. For those of you who have the tapes, I think tape number 370, this January I drew that triangle and up on the triangle going up to the responsibility of the assassination, we get to number 4, which is organized crime and the syndicate. Of course, as I mentioned at the beginning of this tape, telling you about Lee Harvey Oswald's training in the Defense Department, number 9, the top story, or reverse at the bottom line, but I think it works its way up. The Pentagon, the Defense Department that sent Oswald for his special training and to Presidio at Monterey and to Soviet Union as a spy, the Pentagon has to take the responsibility, and they always so far come out clean. They're never criticized, not criticized enough. Those of you who know, as I say, my triangle of power, you know what I think of the admirals or generals, and as I've said before, the autopsy of John Kennedy couldn't be done by Carlos Marcello or Santos Traficana. The admirals and generals did it, and whoever got the autopsy x-rays, if they did, in fact, splice them and put them together the way Robert Groden said they did, then, of course, the biggest cover-up, again, goes to the hands of the Pentagon. Now, I want to make a statement here about Robert Groden, because Robert Groden is the man that represented the various researchers at the House Select Committee on Assassinations. And there are people like Penn Jones who think that Robert Groden is an American folk hero, that the sun rises and sets on Groden, and that he is the most marvelous person because he worked for Henry Luce and Life magazine and came away with Abraham Zapruder films. I have my own view of the researchers, several of them, such as Robert Groden, George O'Toole, Sylvia Marr, Victor Marchetti, Philip Agee, Fletcher Prouty, and Mark Lane. I believe that these people keep a very close set of cards. They give out very little information. If there has to be an authority, they step forward, but they are holding a whole mass of information from the American people on all phases of the assassination that they know more about. And when assassination stories break, they're selected, like being called on the committee or advisors, or they're the critique for the agencies without hitting the real connecting tissue and the nerves of what is making this country sink and fall so badly. Now, Robert Groden, as I say, was one of the researchers who worked with the House Select Committee. And in August, July and August, he knew, according to the newspapers, that those negatives were forged. And he got on national television. He testified September the 6th, the same day as John Connally and Nellie Connally. And he talked about photographic evidence, September 6th, 1978. And he kept silent on these forgeries until the committee had closed shop. That should have been the opening gun to get them started, and he kept silent. On the other side of this tape, I'll talk about a man who didn't keep silent, Dr. Cyril Weck, the only hero out of all this, who said right then and there the shots came from the front and the side, and he demanded the commission hearing it, not the Warren Commission, but this group, to listen to the real evidence in this case.